for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Taliban in Afghanistan are threatening next week's presidential election. A wave of violence in Iraq this week continues to challenge Iraqi security forces following the withdrawal of U.S. troops from urban areas. And in Iran, an opposition candidate in the disputed presidential race says some protesters were tortured to death. Iran's government denies claims of rape and torture of those arrested in crackdowns on election protests. Joining me for the International Hour, the Friday News Roundup, Abdirahim Fukara of Al Jazeera, CNN's Elise Labat, and McClatchy's Warren Strobel. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Abdirahim, let's talk about the Taliban and the warnings of punishment for those who try to participate in an election. How serious are those threats?
Well, obviously, they are being taken very seriously. I think there's probably solace for the president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, that the United States seems to be saying in both words and actions that they want to help the Afghans, not just in terms of organizing an election, but also in terms of securing parts of Afghanistan where the Taliban seem to be resurgent well beyond the election. To what extent do the Taliban take that seriously? I think in the same way that the Iraq war came to define the Bush administration, I think all the indications are there that Afghanistan will ultimately define the Obama administration. I don't think the Taliban threat is going away anytime soon.
Do you agree with that, Elise?
I don't think that the Taliban threat is going away anytime soon, but I do think that this is one of the whole reasons of this recent NATO offensive led by the United States in the Helmand province in the south, because the election is very important, not just to the Afghan people, but to the United States, to show that if we can secure the country and the Afghans can elect a government that can tackle corruption, that can start stabilizing the country, this will show that it was a right thing to do for President Obama to increase troops in Afghanistan. But the Afghan forces are taking the lead in this election. Right now, they're going to be leading the security, and it's very unclear right now whether they have the manpower or the training to do that.
And Warren, with the Taliban threatening to cut off a finger stained with the ink of a vote, how many people will be intimidated from going to those polls?
That's a very good question. There's actually a new poll out this morning, Diane, from the International Republican Institute, which, despite its name, is a nonpartisan U.S. government-funded institute. And that poll says that 50% of the Afghan people will definitely vote, or say they're committed to vote. Another 35% say that they think they probably will vote. So that's a fairly high turnout. There's a couple other interesting things in the poll, too. Most Afghans actually are somewhat optimistic about the future, which they're starting from a very low base, obviously, given the last 30 years. And the poll shows that 44% say they would vote for Hamid Karzai, the current president, 26% for Abdullah, the former foreign minister. That 44% is not enough to get Karzai in the first round. You could have a second round, which could be good in terms of the electoral process, or it could be bad in terms of further confusion, delay, uncertainty, and violence.
So what you're saying is that despite these kinds of threats, people are determined to vote. Do you agree?
Well, we saw a similar trend in early elections in Iraq, where you had a similar situation where basically there were groups and militias threatening Iraqis if they went to the polls. That did not necessarily deter the Iraqis ultimately from going to the polls. One of the fundamental differences, and there are many, between Iraq and Afghanistan as far as this particular issue is concerned, the issue of voter turnout, is the sheer size of Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a much more difficult terrain to secure. And I think what you're hearing, even from U.S. military commanders, is that the main challenge is no longer, although it is, but is no longer just in places like Kabul. It is the far-flung parts of Afghanistan where the Taliban seem to have made a lot of progress in recent months.
There are only about 40 out of 300 and I think 96 provinces in Afghanistan where NATO has a presence. And so a lot of these far-flung districts, as Abdurrahim said, are kind of left out of the game. And these are areas that really need to be brought into the political process. And one of the concern is that these are areas where the Taliban does have a stronghold. And there's a lot of concern about voter fraud. There's a concern that these areas will not be secure. And there's a concern that there wasn't enough time, even with the ramp up, even since President Obama has come to office and the appointment of Richard Holbrooke as a special representative, there hasn't been enough time to prepare this election, to get those census done, to get the voter registration cards done, to set up polling process, to set up polling stations that can be secure. And so there is a lot of concern that there'll be multiple votes. And these are the areas where the Pashtun are, and they're the ones that are most disenfranchised from the political process. And this could be a real problem down the line, Diane.
So considering everything you've just said, is there any indication that the election might be postponed, Warren?
No, not at this point. It's only 6 days away now. I agree with both of what my colleagues had to say about, you know, the security situation. And we're also in this situation, Diane, that's kind of odd, where Obama has so much riding on this, but it's absolutely out of his control. It's the first election in a long time that's run by the Afghans for the Afghans. And but Obama has got, you know, more troops, more money, and the outcome is beyond his control, but it's very much going to affect his future.
One positive thing, I think, for Obama, as far as President Karzai is concerned, and there are a lot of problems besetting President Karzai. One of them is corruption, there's nepotism, there's all those problems that tend to alienate voters. But this time around, he has, on the positive side, managed to rally at least some of the warlords to his side by even inviting them into the political process. Some of them have raised heckles because they are accused of severe human rights violations and so on and so forth. But he is moving in that direction of rallying some of the people who actually matter. Whether that ultimately will, I think it will help him win the vote. It might well help him win the vote. But whether it will actually help him ultimately secure Afghanistan the way that Obama hopes he will is a completely different matter.
And this story tips over into Pakistan, where those forces are taking on the Taliban militants.
Well, in the last week or so, there was a drone attack, and the leader of Pakistani Taliban, Batala Masood, is believed to be killed.
Now, we still don't know.
The U.S. officials are saying he's like, we're 90% sure that he's dead. It's kind of like the Wizard of Oz with the Wicked Witch. Is he very nearly dead or is he most sincerely dead? They don't know. But what we do see is a real jockeying for power, not just among the Pakistani Taliban, but among the Afghan Taliban as well for leadership. Because there's been this debate between the Afghan side and the Pakistani side of the Taliban over the last few years. The Pakistani Taliban is saying, Afghanistan is old news. We really need to go after the Pakistan government, and this is how we're going to stick it to the West. The Afghans are saying, look, we have all these troops, these NATO troops. Afghan is still the target, not Pakistan. So it's not just about jockeying for leadership. It's about strategy. It's about the future of the counterinsurgency. And it's about the relationship with al-Qaeda over both sides of the border.
Warren.
Yeah, I think the death or apparent death or sincerely maybe death of Baitullah Masood, it's good news for Pakistan if it happened, because Baitullah Masood was focusing a lot of, almost all of his efforts on the Pakistani government, the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, and he became public enemy number one for Pakistan. But the people I talked to, and I've heard this from going up to the defense chief of staff of the UK government a couple of weeks ago. What happened there doesn't necessarily immediately translate into good news on the Afghan side of the border. They're interlinked, but they're somewhat separate.
Exactly. Over the long term, it's good that you get rid of the leadership. But the unforeseen consequences now, especially with the election, these people jockeying for power, trying to show that they have superior capability to launch these attacks, this is what they're worried about in the short term.
Why is it that there has been no evidence produced, and yet the claims continue to be made that Badullah Massoud was killed?
Because both sides, the American side and the Pakistani side on the one hand, and the Taliban on the other hand, have a very big interest in their version of what happened being true. For the Americans and the Pakistanis, what's interesting is that it's perhaps one of those very rare occasions when American and Pakistani intelligence speak with one voice. They've both agreed that the Taliban chief has been killed. Whether that's true or not, the Taliban say that it's not. But the timing of it is very interesting. In the run-up to this election in Afghanistan, I think in terms of trying to demoralize the adversary or the enemy, it's very important for the Pakistanis and the Americans to say, although we're talking about the chief in Pakistan, but it's very important for them to be saying to people even in neighboring Afghanistan that one of the chiefs of the Taliban in Pakistan has been killed, hoping that it will boost the chances of people like Karzai in the election process in neighboring Afghanistan.
Abdelrahim Fukara, he's Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera, and Elise Labbitt.
It's okay. I've been called worse.
I'm so glad I have it now, Labbitt, and we'll be right back. And here's a question for our panel this morning, consisting of Elise Labbitt. She's a producer covering the State Department for CNN. Warren Strobel, he's with McClatchy's Washington Bureau. And Abdelrahim Fukara, he's Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera. Here's an email from Natalia in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Is there any real chance anyone but Karzai could win the election? And how relevant is who wins to the U.S. effort in Afghanistan? Warren.
Good questions. If I were a betting man, I would say, of course, there's a chance somebody else could win. But Karzai has all the advantages of incumbency. The Afghan people, by and large, want stability. You have to think that in the end, it's probably going to be Karzai. And I think the Americans are already maneuvering to deal with that eventuality. There's been a lot of friction between the U.S. government and Karzai over the last 6 months or a year over decisions he's made, over corruption, over his perceived ability not or inability to deal with the drug problem. And what you see is the Obama administration already talking about trying to get some sort of prime minister-type position or senior advisor-type position, a technocrat that would have power. Did the same thing in the Palestinian territories a few years ago when Fayyad was put in place the time Arafat was there. And you're also seeing talk about American-sponsored advisors in the ministries and in the provinces to try and so there's not concentration of power, I guess, in Karzai's hands.
I think what's interesting is Karzai has kind of relied on his power base and the warlords, as Abdul Rahim said, for his political support. He really hasn't taken part in many of the debates. He's not doing all that much campaigning in the country, and he really doesn't have a platform. Abdullah Abdullah, the former foreign minister, and Ashraf Ghani, in particular, have really raised the level of debate and offered a kind of strategic plan for where they want to take the country. So I think even if Karzai does end up as president again, he's going to probably have to go through a runoff. There's going to be more debates, and he's really going to be in the hot seat when he is elected. People are going to be looking for him to deliver on some of the platforms that were raised during the campaign.
All right, let's turn now to Iran and allegations of abuse of arrested protesters. They now include death from torture. The BBC has reported that Mehdi Karoubi, an opposition presidential candidate, said on Thursday that some of the protesters arrested after the election were tortured to death. He's the same candidate who earlier in the week said prisoners had been raped.
Well, I think if that's going to do anything, it's obviously just going to make a bad situation worse for President Ahmadinejad. There have been claims of torture and abuse and deaths before in recent weeks. But the fact that you have it now from somebody like Karoubi will obviously compound the pressure on President Ahmadinejad, and it further highlights the split that has actually happened within the ruling establishment in Iran. That is what that is the bigger news, obviously, is the split within the ruling establishment and what it means for the ability of President Ahmadinejad now that almost everyone seems to accept that he is the president of Iran, what it will mean for his ability to deal not just with the internal issue in Iran, but also with the external issue, namely negotiations with the West and in particular the United States over Iran's nuclear issue.
But in this big rift, you've got Larijani, for example, denying these rape allegations and saying that a parliamentary probe into the allegations had found no truth.
Well, I mean, some of these reports are very hard to substantiate because of the crackdown on the media. I mean, the Western media, by and large, is not in there right now. But some of these reports are being posted online, videos, photos, and they're horrific. And what it's doing is really raising the consciousness, not just of the Iranian public, but of also some of these conservative clerics who already were, you know, predisposed not to like Ahmadinejad. And as Abdulrahim said, it's really kind of raising questions about not only the accountability, but the control of the Ahmadinejad government. And I think what's interesting is if you think back to 1979, torture was one of the main justifications for overthrowing the Shah. And so this is just going to, as we were saying, add fuel to the fire and raise questions about whether it's time for this regime, not just Ahmadinejad, but the supreme leader Khamenei, who's been facing enormous opposition over this whole, the way he handled the post-election crisis, to go.
You had Karoubi, in fact, saying that some of the torture and stuff was worse than what happened in 1979 under the things that led to the revolution, which is really an amazing kind of statement.
So,
I also, if I could pick up real quickly on something Abdulrahim said about Ahmadinejad. My colleagues and I, every September, go up to the United Nations to cover the General Assembly, which is the big international gathering of the year. We've seen Ahmadinejad year after year get up there, get a lot of attention. He's cocky, he's brash, he verges on anti-Semitic, he's denouncing the West. I cannot wait to see how he performs, how he handles himself, and more importantly, how the international community, including President Obama, who will be there for the first time, deals with him in September.
But you know, it's interesting that Khamenei demanded that Karoubi himself be put on trial for saying these things, and they've also called for the arrest of Mousavi.
The revolution is eating itself. It really is. It's a rift among the people who started the revolution 30 years ago.
I think the problem that somebody like Khamenei faces, and those who support his position within the ruling establishment in Iran, is is this. If they do something about this, they have a problem. If they don't do anything about it, they have a problem. If they do anything about it, then obviously the opposition will grow bolder and more dangerous to the status quo in Iran. If they try to do something about it, then obviously that will again bolster the opposition, in the sense that one of the things it will do, it will highlight international criticism. And international criticism obviously does reverberate inside Iran, and it does weather the leaders of the opposition like accusations that international criticism gives them ammunition or not. But it does give them ammunition in their face-off with people like Ahmadinejad.
And Elise, what is the fate of the Newsweek journalist who strayed apparently into Iran?
Well, you have a couple of detainees. You have a Newsweek journalist, Mazhar Bahari, who's been working in Iran, who's been licensed by the Iranian government to work, and whose coverage, frankly, of the regime hasn't been all that critical. And he's been caught up in this post-election crisis. He's one of more than 40 journalists that are being tried as part of hundreds of opposition leaders, some of the most well-respected people of the country, like Shireen Abadi, noted Nobel laureate, and there's been a large campaign by Newsweek to free him. And then you have American hikers that were hiking in northern Iraq in the Kurdish area in the mountains, and it seems as if they strayed into straight into Iran and were detained by the authorities. And after a kind of week or so of no news whatsoever, the Iranians have finally confirmed that they do have them. They are in custody. There's been no consular access, no visits to them at all. What U.S. officials are saying is that they don't think that Iran is irrational in these situations, and that eventually it'll probably shake out like it did in 2007 when Iran picked up these several British soldiers, held them, milked them for all they were worth. And then when the international outrage and cost of them were too high, they had this ceremony and they let them go. So they kind of think that after these hikers, they find out that they've satisfied themselves, that they really didn't pose any risk. The Iraqi government now is getting involved, saying, you know, they were really guests of our country and they just strayed in. Please let them go. That eventually, as they did with Rukhsana Sabari, journalists, they'll let them go.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case. You did have one sort of hard line, I think it was a member of parliament, I hope I'm not wrong on that, say that the only reason these they three people could have strayed across the border is because they are part of the Western plot to keep things unhinged in Iran. But by and large, I think Elise is probably right that they will be released after.
They just couldn't have done it they couldn't have done it at a worse time. I mean, there should be some warning on your passport
not to
go into these countries.
You bet.
Yeah, I mean, regardless of this this ball being kicked back and forth between the Iranian government and the United States government as to the nature of what actually happened when those hikers went into Iranian territory. I mean, in these situations, you inevitably have a new card to play if you're the Iranian government when it comes to negotiations. It just puts one added step on the road to negotiations between the Iranian government and the U.S. government. Instead of cutting straight to the chase and talking about pressure regarding the nuclear issue, now the U.S. government has this extra hurdle of the three hikers to actually clear before they can talk about any other substance.
And speaking of hurdles, a new wave of violence in Iraq this week, Warren Strobel.
Yes, indeed. I think yesterday there was two suicide bombings in the Mosul area targeted against an ethnic minority, religious minority called the Yazidis. 21 people killed. It's the latest in a string of these ever since U.S. combat troops left the cities on June 30.
So since last Friday, we've had 150 people killed.
It's a lot, and it's though actually you talk to American commanders, they think they predicted even worse. In other words, it's terrible. I'm not trying to minimize it in any sense of the word, but there was a concern that there would be an even larger wave of violence. And so
how is the Iraqi security handling this?
You know, they're doing better. You had this memo from the American colonel that was published in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago saying that the Iraqi security forces are just barely good enough and it's time for us to leave. Iraq is still very unstable, and the big concern now is the fault line between the Kurdish areas and the Arab areas, and the concern about a full-scale ethnic conflict there, which we have not seen yet, thank God, but it's a possibility.
And also, as Warren said, they're really trying to fuel an already existing tension between the Arab and the Kurdish government in the north. But also, up until recently, when we've seen these bombings in the north, the bombing campaign has really been directed at the Shia. And and the bombings have just been horrific. They've been, you know, on food lines, you know, school buses, funerals, hospitals, really aimed at the Shia and trying to drag them back into a sectarian war. And the Shia, by and large, have been very patient. Their spiritual leaders, like Grand Ayatollah Sistani, have told them, you know, listen, no retaliation, renounce violence. And this is, they by and large, they've been patient, but I think people are waiting to see how long that patience will last and whether we'll see the militias come again.
Elise Labbitt, she's a producer covering the State Department for CNN. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And Elise, Secretary of State Clinton's trip to Africa. Tell us what you believe she accomplished.
Well, it was a grueling 7-nation, 11-day tour designed to highlight how the U.S. wants to really strengthen partnerships in Africa and build economic links, especially in large oil-producing countries. One of the reasons of that is because of China, because China has been heavily invested in the region, especially in these big oil-producing countries like Angola. And so Secretary Clinton really wanted to expand on the idea of the U.S. strengthening its partnerships in Africa. I don't think she broke any new ground on any policies, but she did highlight a lot of areas such as good governance, corruption. She tackled very sensitive issues like sexual violence against women in the Congo. And I think it did go a long way to highlight the idea that the U.S. does see Africa as a strategic priority.
Just on a personal note, I'm extremely happy that Secretary Hillary Clinton went to Africa, because one of the most important messages that she kept hammering is that, look, Africa is not all bad news. There's a lot of good news coming out of Africa. And the issue of South Africa, for example, I mean, my goodness, one of the main positive stories of the century came out of South Africa, the collapse of apartheid. So I'm glad that she made the trip and she made those statements. There's one story that sort of slipped through the net as far as the coverage is concerned. Elise alluded to it. And the guy, the student who rattled Hillary Clinton during her visit, alluded to it, the role of China and how that actually ties into AFRICOM. The issue of since the United States under the Bush administration decided to actually create AFRICOM, this central command in Africa, there's been a lot of opposition to hosting it by several African governments, and I think that opposition continues today. I find it extremely hard that Hillary Clinton has been traveling around Africa talking about all these issues. I find it extremely hard that she would not have pressed some of those governments that she held talks with about hosting AFRICOM.
Looking from the outside here in Washington, it looks like the trip was great for U.S.-African relations. I mean, President Obama has been to Ghana. Hillary Clinton has now spent, 11 days in Africa. They're paying early attention to the continent. It's actually a continent where, more than any other place around the world, the United States is popular, even during the worst depths of the Bush administration. But in terms of Hillary Clinton herself, I don't think the trip went so well, in the sense that she made this remark, and for better or worse, it overshadowed a lot of what she was trying to do.
You're talking about the remark she made when this young man asked a question which it has been said was mistranslated. The question was, what does Mr. Clinton think about this?
And this poor university student in the Congo evidently meant to say, what does President Obama think about this? But in terms of the coverage back here and around the world, unfortunately, that has overshadowed a lot of what she was trying to accomplish. And to me, it sort of reinforces an image of a Secretary of State who doesn't quite yet feel comfortable in her role, who has, from time to time, and at least would know better than I, said things that are pretty undiplomatic.
Well, I must say, I think the attention she brought to the issue of rape in the Congo, we did a full hour on that yesterday. And I must say, it seems to me that that was a positive thing for her to be talking about, to bring attention to an horrific crime of war that is now being used in the Congo. We're going to take just a short break here. When we come back, we'll open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by this and other NPR stations, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by Judy and Steve Hopkins, supporting the Shakespeare Theater Company's The Taming of the Shrew, August 27th through September 12th at Sidney Harmon Hall, Washington, D.C. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember the great guitarist and inventor Les Paul, who's died at the age of 94. He developed new recording techniques which helped create the modern sound of rock and roll. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And now it's time for your questions and comments. First to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Dimitri. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. May I digress and return to the subject of Afghanistan?
Certainly.
I want to make a statement, and then I have a question for your panel.
All right.
The fragmentation of the Afghani culture has been created by the invasion and occupation of foreign powers. It began years ago, and the first known one that I can think about is the British invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, and unfortunately, that invasion force that had only one survivor to return to England. And then that began the fragmentation and the divisions in the Afghani culture.
And your question, sir?
My question is that the Russians continue doing this thing, and now Americans are over there, and they're continually, this fragmentation can only be resolved by dealing with the Taliban. Obama will have to sit down and talk to the Taliban because they're the only unifying and force in Afghanistan
Thank you for your question.
On the issue of the British, it is very ironic that the Pakistanis are being asked by the Obama administration to monitor and secure the border with Afghanistan. That border was randomly drawn by the British in the 1800s. So it's very ironic that Afghanis that the Pakistanis are being asked to actually take care of that border when the Afghanis do not accept it. And, you know, that cuts straight into the issue of the fragmentation and how the borders were randomly drawn at that time. Look, the issue of the Taliban, yes, there seems to be some sort of consensus that one of the best things that the Obama administration could do is to, in one way or another, bring in the Taliban, those elements of the Taliban who may be willing. I don't know if they actually exist, but there are reports that they do exist, who may want to lay down their arms. Afghanistan, in my view, is like Iraq. It will never be brought back together the way some Americans seem to be talking about that. Afghanistan and Iraq will continue for a long time, I think, to be a managed crisis rather than a model of stability anytime soon.
All right, let's follow up with Judy from Ben Salem, Pennsylvania. Good morning, you're on the air.
Hello. I have to agree with the man who preceded me. Yesterday, General McChrystal said that the Taliban was winning. And then immediately Gates got on and a number of the other bigwigs got on and said, well, you know, it's not really that bad. And Obama said during the campaign, I'm not against all wars, but I am against dumb wars. Haven't we learned enough from Iraq that these countries, you know, unless we pay off the people, and I know that's a very brutal way to say it, but Anwar, we paid those people off, and we're going to have to pay off the Taliban in order to get some kind of peace there.
Maybe less expensive than the war that is currently being waged.
Yeah, I mean, I think the caller has a good point there. And I want to agree also with Abdulrahim. This is going to be a managed crisis for a long time. Afghanistan is it's a very diverse and decentralized country. We're going to be spending money and time there for a long time to come. As far as the Taliban, people talk as if the Taliban is some kind of gang or some kind of foreign implant. The Taliban are going to be there even when this thing is over. They're a Pashtun movement that has wide support within society, and I think the idea is to try and eliminate the most radical of the Taliban and then bring the others into some sort of power-sharing arrangement.
All right, to Curly in Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Todd. And my question is this. In light of the fact that George Bush has gotten us into a war in Iraq that is ultimately illegitimate, I honestly don't think we had any business there to start with. Afghanistan, yes. Okay, we're in this area, this region over there. We know that this is not going to – the area over there is never going to be like we – you know, like some of these people in America feel like they want it to be, you know, imposing some kind of a democracy on people that don't know how to live like that. How do we get out of this place? I'm not talking about without losing face. Who cares about that? How do we get out of this thing alive?
Good question, Elise.
Well, it is a very good question, and it's not just a military solution as we know. It's a political situation and a political reconciliation and finishing the constitutional bargain that was never finished in 2005. And I think one of the issues of the whole surge and the U.S. increasing its troops over the last few years was it was supposed to give space for political reconciliation to take part, and that never happened. And you still have these simmering tensions, many fault lines in Iraq, not just between Sunni and Shia, Shia and Kurd, you know, religious versus, you know, secular. And so any of these fault lines can really set Iraq on a different course. And I think one of the concern right now on this whole violence directed against the Shia, one of the concerns not only by the Shia, but the U.S., is the lack of outrage in the region. And this really plays into why the Arab states are not supporting, you know, the Shia in this. Iraq is the only Shia-led country in the region, and the Arabs do not like that. And so they definitely want, the U.S. wants the Arab world to show more outrage and stop people in their country from supporting these Sunni extremists that are launching attacks and trying to fuel this sectarian war. I think it's a political answer at this point.
But the primary question, as I heard it, was why are we still in Afghanistan? What is the goal in Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, there are many different goals in Afghanistan. I mean, one of the stark similarities between Afghanistan and Iraq is the extent of regional involvement in a place like both Iraq and Afghanistan. You have the Pakistanis, you have the Indians, you have the Iranians. Everyone is involved in a place like Pakistan. And then this is something that the Obama administration inherited from the Bush administration. And the Bush administration, we all know under what conditions he actually got into Afghanistan. So there are many different goals. One is U.S., if you look at it from the point of view of the Obama administration, is U.S. national security. But even if the Obama administration tried to get out of Afghanistan now, there are regional pressures on the Obama administration. If you're thinking about the face-off between India and Pakistan, for example, who are fighting their surrogate war, if you will, through various parties in Afghanistan, that makes it very difficult for the Obama administration to get out. Although it is unfortunate for the Afghanis that the Obama administration has actually inherited this issue at a time when the United States has its own domestic economic problems, which makes it very tough to keep on talking just in terms of sending more troops or in terms of paying people off. You cannot keep on paying people off indefinitely.
You know, there was a commentator on Morning Edition this morning who talked about the fact that the Obama administration is going at the question of Afghanistan in totally the wrong way, that pouring more troops, pouring more money into Afghanistan is not going to rid us of the problem. Rather, we need to simply pull back and protect ourselves.
I listened to that interview with Andrew Bacevich from Boston University, and it was really interesting. And Andrew Bacevich has this long habit, if you will, of looking at both Iraq and Iran and Pakistan rationally. The problem begins when you ask people like Bacevich, okay, so what do you suggest? Then, you know, they scratch their head, and nobody has a really rational, good solution as to what to do about either Iraq or Afghanistan at this particular point in time, other than what we said before, to keep on managing it as a crisis. Afghanistan, even if the U.S. administration were to withdraw from Afghanistan, Afghanistan will for a long time remain a remarkably poor and unstable place.
To Wilmington, North Carolina. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
Thanks for your show.
Thank you.
Very educational, informational. Returning to the situation with the apprehended females there in Korea and also the three in Iran, three quick questions for you, your guest, please, to comment on. Number one, should it be a crime? Should the Congress make a law that's a crime to cross borders like that and get apprehended? If they're free, then they should have some answers. Should have some penalties for it. Also, what's the likelihood or possibility that the ladies were not cross the borders, but they were just snatched across? And if they were indeed across the borders, why would they be so bold and brazen to get caught like this? Because it could have serious consequences in these cases. Hopefully they won't be that serious. Thank you very much, and I'll take answer off the phone.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for the question, Robert. I don't want Congress to make a law like that because it would impede us from doing our reporting, obviously. I mean, we need to sometimes cross borders, obviously in a legal manner, but you don't want to, I don't think, go down that road. I think what you have going on here, these are separate cases in North Korea, in Iran, but you have a situation where when I started in this business, journalists were considered sort of, by and large, off limits. And more that is not the case. Journalists are being killed, they're being kidnapped, et cetera. And I also think you have a growing number of young journalists who are out there covering the world for internet-based publications, for independent TV outlets, who might, I'm not saying in this case, but in some cases may not be quite the experienced foreign correspondents we knew in the past.
All right. And to Baltimore, Maryland, Boniface, you're on the air.
Okay. Well, good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
Oh, you know, I like your jazz program, really, because you talk about very good issues.
I'm so glad.
Yes. And then I come from the Rwanda area, and I was just impressed by the coverage of the visit of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. But about the issue of rape, yes, I think the main issue is to focalize on how to stop the conflict, the fighting in Congo, because most of the time, soldiers in those countries, because there is not rule of law, so actually rape is just like sexual satisfaction. So there is undiscipline. So when they fight, they get women, they want to satisfy the sexual needs.
Actually, I think what Hillary Clinton was doing was saying that rape is an act of violence. Rape is an act of war.
And it's a tool of war. And so she was talking about getting at the root causes, but that rape is one of those issues. And the U.S. kind of threw some money at the government to try and deal with these issues. But, you know, this is one of Hillary Clinton's issues, that she wants to focus on how women are affected in these type of wars.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Clinton, New York. Good morning, Susan. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. This my comment and actually question is for Mr. Strobel. About a half an hour ago, Mr. Strobel, you referred to Ahmadinejad of Iran and characterized his remarks, I believe, at the UN as either almost or near anti-Semitic. Mr. Ahmadinejad at the UN has called, and in other venues, has termed the Holocaust a lie. He has denied the Holocaust. He's called for Israel, God forbid, to be wiped off the face of the earth. I'd like to know from you, and I'm laughing, obviously, with a sense of black humor, what would you consider a full-fledged anti-Semitic remark from Mr. Ahmadinejad?
Absolutely, I agree with you. The remarks about the Holocaust, there's no other way to characterize them. I was referring to a specific speech that he gave at the UN General Assembly the year before, where he talked about Zionist conspiracies and so forth. So there's no doubt in my mind that his comments are anti-Semitic. My larger point was, how's the world going to deal with him in a month when he's up there speaking at the rostrum?
How do you think that will go?
Well, I think it could go either one of two ways. He could either sort of reflect the shakiness of the ground on which he stands domestically and tone down the rhetoric during the General Assembly, or he could actually try and put a brave face on and carry on as if nothing had happened. But look, the major issue that he faces now is, as far as dealing with Israel and the United States, is the nuclear issue. That is really the challenge. There have been openings from the Obama administration. They're putting negotiations at the top of the list. The Israelis, though, do not have the kind of patience that the Obama administration seems to want them to have when it comes to dealing with Iran's nuclear issue.
And finally, the issue of Myanmar and pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi. She has now been sentenced to 18 more months of house arrest through an incident that apparently was no fault of her own.
There was an American who swam to her house, seems to be a little mentally unstable, we've heard, and he said that he had a premonition of an assassination plot and he was going to help her. the regime took the opportunity to arrest her for violating the terms of the parole. She was convicted, and then at first it was a 3 years in a labor camp, and now it's more 18 months of house arrest. The U.S. thought the U.S. has been sending signals to the regime there that it wanted to re-engage, and it's not sure whether the fact that they lightened the sentence is a signal that Burma is ready to do that. They thought if they let her go that it would have been huge. Now they're trying to judge what does this mean for future of U.S.-Burmese relations.
And isn't Senator Jim Webb about to go?
Senator Jim Webb is there today. He's not only expected to, he's the first, the highest level official and the first senator to go there in 10 years. So it's really remarkable. And what he's going to discuss is not just Aung San Suu Kyi, but many other issues about U.S. and Burma.
Elise Labbitt, she's a producer covering the State Department for CNN. Warren Strobel of McClatchy Washington Bureau, and Abdirahim Fukara, he's Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Arabic. And I wish you all a happy weekend. Enjoy. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Reed.